Chapter 6. Glenard moved away impatiently. Such talk was as tedious as the buzzing of gnats. He wondered why his wife had wanted to drag him on such a senseless expedition. He hated Flamel's crowd, and what business had Flamel himself to interfere in that way, standing up for the publication of the letters, as though Glenard needed his defense? Glenard turned his head and saw that Flamel had drawn a seat to Alixa's elbow, and was speaking to her in a low tone. The other groups had scattered, straying in twos along the deck. It came over Glenard that he should never again be able to see Flamel speaking to his wife without the sense of sick mistrust that now loosened his joints. Alixa, the next morning, over their early breakfast, surprised her husband by an unexpected request. "Will you bring me those letters from town?" she asked. "What letters?" he said, putting down his cup. He felt himself as helplessly vulnerable as a man who has lunched at in the dark. "Mrs. Aubin's. The book they were all talking about yesterday." Glenard, carefully measuring his second cup of tea, said, with deliberation, "I didn't know you cared about that sort of thing." She was, in fact, not a great reader, and a new book seldom reached her till it was, so to speak, on the home stretch. But she replied, with a gentle tenacity, "I think it would interest me, because I read her life last year." "Her life? Where did you get that?" "Someone lent it to me, when it came out, Mr. Flamel, I think." His first impulse was to exclaim, "Why the devil do you borrow books of Flamel? I can buy you all you want," but he felt himself irresistibly forced into an attitude of smiling compliance. "Flamel always has the newest books going, hasn't he? You must be careful, by the way, about returning what he lends you. He's rather crotchety about his library." "Oh, I'm always very careful," she said, with a touch of competence that struck him, and she added, as he caught up his hat, "Don't forget the letters." Why had she asked for the book? Was her sudden wish to see it the result of some hint of Flamel's? The thought turned Glenard sick, but he preserved sufficient lucidity to tell himself, a moment later, that his last hope of self-control would be lost if he yielded to the temptation of seeing a hidden purpose in everything she said and did. How much Flamel guessed, he had no means of divining, nor could he predicate, from what he knew of the man, to what use his inferences might be put. The very qualities that had made Flamel a useful advisor made him the most dangerous of accomplices. Glenard felt himself agrope among alien forces that his own act had set in motion. Alixa was a woman of few requirements, but her wishes, even in trifles, had a definiteness that distinguished them from the fluid impulses of her kind. He knew that, having once asked for the book, she would not forget it. And he put aside, as an ineffectual expedient, his momentary idea of applying for it at the circulating library and telling her that all the copies were out. If the book was to be bought, it had better be bought at once. He left his office earlier than usual, and turned in at the first bookshop on his way to the train. The show window was stacked with conspicuously lettered volumes. Argarid Aubin flashed back at him in endless repetition. He plunged into the shop, and came on a counter, where the name reiterated itself on row after row of bindings. It seemed to have driven the rest of literature to the back shelves. He caught up a copy, tossing the money to an astonished clerk who pursued him to the door with the unheeded offer to wrap up the volumes. In the street he was seized with a sudden apprehension. What if he were to meet Flamel? The thought was intolerable. He called a cab, and drove straight to the station where, amid the palm leaf fans of a perspiring crowd, he waited a long half hour for his train to start. He had thrust a volume in either pocket, and in the train he dared not draw them out, but the detested words leaped at him from the folds of the evening paper. The air seemed full of Margaret Aubin's name. The motion of the train set it dancing up and down on the page of a magazine that a man in front of him was reading. At the door he was told that Mrs. Glennard was still out, and he went upstairs to his room and dragged the books from his pocket. They lay on the table before him like live things that he feared to touch. At length he opened the first volume. A familiar letter sprang out at him, each word quickened by its glaring garb of type. The little broken phrases fled across the page like wounded animals in the open. It was a horrible sight. A battue of helpless things driven savagely out of shelter. He had not known it would be like this. He understood now that, at the moment of selling the letters, he had viewed the transaction solely as it affected himself, as an unfortunate blemish on an otherwise presentable record. He had scarcely considered the act in relation to Margaret Aubyn, for death, if it hallows, also makes innocuous. Glennard's God was a God of the living, of the immediate, the actual, the tangible. All his days he had lived in the presence of that God, heedless of the divinities who, below the surface of our deeds and passions, silently forge the fatal weapons of the dead. Via, a knock roused him, and looking up he saw his wife. He met her glance in silence, and she faltered out, "Are you ill?" The words restored his self-possession. "Ill? Of course not. They told me you were out, and I came upstairs." The books lay between them on the table. He wondered when she would see them. She lingered tentatively on the threshold, with the air of leaving his explanation on his hands. She was not the kind of woman who could be counted on to fortify an excuse by appearing to dispute it. "Where have you been?" Glennard asked, moving forward so that he obstructed her vision of the books. "I walked over to the Dreshams for tea." "I can't think what you see in those people," he said with a shrug, adding, "uncontrollably suppose Flamel was there?" "No, he left on the yacht this morning." An answer so obstructing to the natural escape of his irritation left Glennard with no momentary resource but that of strolling impatiently to the window. As her eyes followed him, they lit on the books. "Ah, you've brought them. I'm so glad," she exclaimed. He answered over his shoulder, "For a woman who never reads, you make the most astounding exceptions." Her smile was an exasperating concession to the probability that it had been hot in town, or that something had bothered him. "Do you mean it's not nice to want to read the book?" she asked. "It was not nice to publish it, certainly. But after all, I'm not responsible for that, am I?" She paused, and, as he made no answer, went on, still smiling, "I do read sometimes, you know, and I'm very fond of Margaret Aubyn's books. I was reading Pomegranate Seed when we first met. Don't you remember? It was then you told me all about her." Glennard had turned back into the room, and stood staring at his wife. "Ell about her?" he repeated, and with the words remembrance came to him. He had found Miss Trent one afternoon with the novel in her hand, and moved by the lover's fatuous impulse to associate himself in some way with whatever fills the mind of the beloved, had broken through his habitual silence about the past. Rewarded by the consciousness of figuring impressively in Miss Trent's imagination, he had gone on from one anecdote to another, reviving dormant details of his old Hillbridge life, and pasturing his vanity on the eagerness with which she received his reminiscences of a being already clothed in the impersonality of greatness. The incident had left no trace in his mind, but it sprang up now like an old enemy, the more dangerous for having been forgotten. The instinct of self-preservation, sometimes the most perilous that man can exercise, made him awkwardly declare, "I used to see her at people's houses, that was all," and her silence as usual leaving room for a multiplication of blunders. He added, with interest and indifference, "I simply can't see what you can find to interest you in such a book." She seemed to consider this intently. "Who have read it, then?" "I glanced at it. I never read such things." "Is it true that she didn't wish the letters to be published?" Glennard felt the sudden dizziness of the mountaineer on a narrow ledge, and with it the sense that he was lost if he looked more than a step ahead. I'm sure I don't know, he said. Then, summoning a smile, he passed his hand through her arm. Didn't have tea at the Dreshams, you know. Won't you give me some now, he suggested. That evening Leonard, under pretext of work to be done, shut himself into the small study opening off the drawing room. As he gathered up his papers he said to his wife Colin, you're not going to sit indoors on such a night as this. I'll join you presently outside. But as he had drawn her armchair to the lamp, want to look at my book, she said, taking up the first volume of the Eddars. Glenard, with a shrug, withdrew into the study. I'm going to shut the door. I want to be quiet, he explained from the threshold, and she nodded without lifting her eyes from the book. He sank into a chair, staring aimlessly at the outspread papers. How was he to work, while on the other side of the door she sat with that volume in her hand? The door did not shut her out. He saw her distinctly, felt her close to him in a contact as painful as the pressure on a bruise. The sensation was part of the general strangeness that made him feel like a man waking from a long sleep to find himself in an unknown country among people of alien tongue. We live in our own souls as in an unmapped region, a few acres of which we have cleared for our habitation. While of the nature of those nearest us, we know but the boundaries that march with ours. Of the points in his wife's character not in direct contact with his own, Glenard now discerned his ignorance, and the baffling sense of her remoteness was intensified by the discovery that, in one way, she was closer to him than ever before. As one may live for years in happy unconsciousness of the possession of a sensitive nerve, he had lived beside his wife unaware that her individuality had become a part of the texture of his life, ineradicable as some growth on a vital organ, and he now felt himself at once incapable of forecasting her judgment and powerless to evade its effects. To escape, the next morning, the confidences of the breakfast table, he went to town earlier than usual. His wife, who read slowly, was given to talking over what she read, and at present his first object in life was to postpone the inevitable discussion of the letters. This instinct of protection in the afternoon, on his way uptown, guided him to the club in search of a man who might be persuaded to come out to the country to dine. The only man in the club was Flamel. Glenard, as he heard himself almost involuntarily pressing Flamel to come and dine, felt the full irony of the situation. To use Flamel as a shield against his wife's scrutiny was only a shade less humiliating than to reckon on his wife as a defense against Flamel. He felt a contradictory movement of annoyance at the latter's ready acceptance, and the two men drove in silence to the station. As they passed the bookstall in the waiting room, Flamel lingered a moment, and the eyes of both fell on Margaret Aubin's name, conspicuously displayed above a counter stacked with the familiar volumes. We shall be late, you know, Glenard remonstrated, pulling out his watch. Go ahead, said Flamel, imperturbably. Want to get something? Glenard turned on his heel and walked down the platform. Flamel rejoined him with an innocent-looking magazine in his hand, but Glenard dared not even glance at the cover, lest it should show the syllables he feared. The train was full of people they knew, and they were kept apart till it dropped them at the little suburban station. As they strolled up the shaded hill, Glenard talked volubly, pointing out the improvements in the neighborhood, deploring the threatened approach of an electric railway, and screening himself by a series of reflex adjustments from the imminent risk of any allusion to the Eddars. Flamel suffered his discourse with the bland inattention that we accord to the affairs of someone else's suburb, and they reached the shelter of Alexa's tea table without a perceptible turn toward the dreaded topic. The dinner passed off safely. Flamel, always at his best in Alexa's presence, gave her the kind of attention which is like a beaconing light thrown on the speaker's words. His answers seemed to bring out a latent significance in her phrases, as the sculptor draws his statue from the block. Glenard, under his wife's composure, detected a sensibility to this maneuver, and the discovery was like a lightning flash across a nocturnal landscape. Thus far these momentary illuminations had served only to reveal the strangeness of the intervening country. Each fresh observation seemed to increase the sum total of his ignorance. Her simplicity of outline was more puzzling than a complex surface. One may conceivably work one's way through a labyrinth, but Alexa's candor was like a snow-covered plain where, the road once lost, there are no landmarks to travel by. Dinner over, they returned to the veranda, where a moon, rising behind the old elm, was combining with that complacent tree a romantic enlargement of their borders. Glenard had forgotten the cigars. He went to his study to fetch them, and in passing through the drawing room he saw the second volume of the Eders lying open on his wife's table. He picked up the book and looked at the date of the letter as he had been reading. It was one of the last. He knew the few lines by heart. He dropped the book and leaned against the wall. Why had he included that one among the others? Or was it possible that now they would all seem like that? Alexa's voice came suddenly out of the dusk. It was right, it is like listening at a keyhole. I wish I hadn't read. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.